In the vast expanse of the gaming cosmos, where the stars of innovation and nostalgia align, lies a planet teeming with secrets, dangers, and treasures beyond imagination. This is a place that would become the battleground for one of the most iconic adventures in video game history. In the early 90s, a time when the gaming industry was exploring new frontiers and pushing the boundaries of what video games could be, a masterpiece emerged that would forever change the landscape of action-adventure gaming. This game was Super Metroid, released by Nintendo in 1994 for the Super Nintendo Entertainment System. Super Metroid wasn't just a game. It was a journey into the unknown, a symphony of pixel art and sound that crafted an atmosphere both eerie and exhilarating. With its nonlinear gameplay, atmospheric storytelling, and innovative mechanics, like the iconic Morph Ball, Super Metroid set a new standard for the action-adventure genre. It was a game that didn't just challenge the player's skill, but also their imagination and sense of discovery. Today, we're going to take you back to the legendary world of Super Metroid, to relive the adventure that captivated millions, and to celebrate the legacy of a game that continues to inspire developers and delight gamers around the globe 30 years later. So ready your power suit and set your sight on Zeebs. It's time to embark on a journey to the heart of one of gaming's greatest masterpieces on today's trip down Memory Card Lane. Morning, good afternoon, and good evening. I hope these words find you well. Hello, and welcome to the 186th episode of our video game history podcast, A Trip Down Memory Card Lane. Each week, we'll tell you a story relevant to the current week in gaming history. It can be about a game or the people that created it. It can be about a console or the technology that brought it to life. We often talk about the companies that bring it all together, making our hobby a reality. While telling you each story, we hope to teach you something new about the topic, what it took from the world as its inspiration, or what it gave back to the world in its legacy. Today, we're going back to one of the most influential games in the action-adventure genre, Super Metroid. It was released for the Super Nintendo Entertainment System. It is a game that has not only perfected the formula for its predecessors, but also set a standard for its genre that is still felt to this day. I'm David Kasten, and as always, I'm joined by my co-host, who's been known to navigate the complexities of Zeebs with the ease of Samus Aran, navigating through a space pirate stronghold. That was a mouthy one. He's my brother, Rob Kasten. Rob, you ever find yourself wishing that your suit could turn you into a morph ball to get through tight spots in traffic?
Oh, what a time save that would be, Dave. I could just zip, zap, zoop, get right to where I gotta go, and, you know, I probably would still be late knowing me, but it'd make it a lot easier getting there on time.
Very true. Also joining us for, I believe it's a record fourth time, it's repeat guest Ryan Shepherd. Ryan, question. Where do you get off stealing brain-shaped babies all the time?
You know, you develop a taste for it, and that's all you want to do.
Fair enough.
Do you wish that you could turn yourself into a morph ball?
I would be the best hide-and-seek player of all time.
Oh, that's a good point. Damn, I didn't even think of that.
That's very true. Oh, that's fantastic. All right, Ryan, well, welcome back. It's nice to have you. Rob, before I take it into our little jaunt down memory card lane, why don't you tell us about the current week in gaming history?
Sure thing, Dave. In March 21st of 1969, Konami takes its first steps. And on this day, it was founded by Kagemasa Kozuki as a small repair business for jukeboxes and slot machines in Osaka, Japan. The humble beginning would lay the foundation for what would become one of the most influential and prolific video game companies in the industry. Konami would go on to create iconic franchises such as Metal Gear, Castlevania, Contra, Silent Hill, and many others, significantly shaping the gaming landscape with its innovative and genre-defining titles.
Didn't we do an episode on Konami? We did.
I believe. Was it on Konami? Was it? I mean, we did.
We've Metal done Gear. A bunch. We've done Metal Gear. We've done Contra. We've done Silent Hill.
Ah, I forgot about Silent Hill.
The only one in that bunch we haven't done is Castlevania, and that's coming up later this year, I believe.
Ah, there you go. So pretty soon we'll have the whole bunch.
Mm-hmm.
On March 17th, 1995, The Amazing Spider-Man Lethal Foes swings onto the Super Famicom. Exclusive to Japan, this allowed players to step into the web-slinging shoes of the iconic Marvel superhero. With a variety of Spider-Man's most notorious villains making appearances, the game captures the essence of the comic book series with its action-packed gameplay and vibrant graphics, though it remained a hidden gem due to its limited release. We just covered the whole spectrum of Spider-Man back in episode 176, so go check it out.
Yeah. Spider-Man.
On March 22nd of 1996, Resident Evil was introduced to the PlayStation, birthing the survival horror genre. Set in the eerie Spencer Mansion, players must navigate puzzles, manage limited resources, and survive against the horrors within, marking the beginning of a franchise renowned for its chilling atmosphere and storytelling. We talked about it back in episode 30, so if you're interested, go check it out.
Hey, Ryan.
Yes, sir?
You a Resident Evil fan?
Yes, most especially 2 and 4 were my love childs back in the day.
That's a good answer. That's a very good answer. All right, Rob, what else we got?
Well, on March 20th, 1997, Castlevania Symphony of the Night was released for PlayStation by Konami, revolutionizing the Castlevania series with its nonlinear exploration and RPG elements. As players take on the role of Alucard, Dracula's son, they uncover the vast, mysterious castle of Dracula, filled with hidden rooms, powerful artifacts, and intricate plot twists. Its innovative gameplay, combined with captivating graphics and a hauntingly beautiful soundtrack, not only earned critical acclaim, but also helped establish the Metroidvania genre, influencing countless games in the years to follow. And we covered it back in episode 78, if you want to learn more.
Also one of my favorite games of all time, and today we're doing Super Metroid, and that's Castlevania Symphony of the Night, and those are the two games that probably best defined the genre.
Oh, Metroidvania, got it.
Do you remember the twist? Either of you remember the twist of that game? Ryan,
I never played it.
Ryan, did you play that one?
I only played it... unfortunately, years later. I did not have a PlayStation at the time.
But so you played it.
I have.
There's two castles. That's the twist, Rob.
Oh, was the princess in the other one?
Actually, it's even better than that. So you go through the entire castle, and the game acts the whole time like it's the castle, right? Because you're working your way up to 100%. And then you get to the end, and then you get introduced to another castle that's inverted. It's the entire thing, like, mirrored and inverted.
Nice.
And then you work your way up to, I believe it's just over 200% was the final percentage of the game, because I didn't want to give away the fact that there were two castles. It was such a cool concept. I love that game. What is the good quote from it? What is a man? Nothing more than just a miserable bag of bones or something like that. Oh, that's such a great line. Okay.
Miserable pile of secrets.
Yeah, that's it. That's so great. A miserable pile of secrets. That's fantastic.
Alrighty. Well, moving along with our week in gaming history, on March 18th of 2004, Katamari Damacy comes to the PlayStation 2, captivating players with its quirky concept, charming visuals, and unforgettable soundtrack. Tasked with rolling up objects to recreate stars and constellations for the king of all cosmos, players navigate through increasingly complex levels with a growing Katamari ball. This innovative and whimsical game not only garnered a cult following, but also inspired a new genre of puzzle action games, proving that creativity and originality can create a lasting impact in the world of video gaming.
It's a weird game, and I love it. I love them. They're fantastic. All right, what else we got?
Well, on March 17th of 2005, Marvelous Interactive brings the charm of farm life to the Nintendo DS with the release of Harvest Moon DS. Integrating classic farming simulation elements with innovative touchscreen controls, this installment offers players the opportunity to manage their own farm, forge relationships, and explore the mysteries of Forget-Me-Not Valley. Harvest Moon DS continues to enchant with its relaxing gameplay and endearing story, marking a cherished addition to the beloved Harvest Moon series. And we discuss the original Harvest Moon back in episode 41, so give it a check.
We did. We did a whole episode on... God, what was Harvest Moon called first? And remember? Something Seasons? Yeah, I know. You don't ever. It's okay. Song of Seasons?
Story of Seasons?
Yeah, I think it might be Story of Seasons. You're right. All right, Rob, what else happened this week?
Well, on March 20th, 2006, The Elder Scrolls IV Oblivion was unleashed by Bethesda Softworks.
That's my entry into the Elder Scrolls series, personally.
Yeah, actually, Sam, it would have been mine as well. So, for those that don't know, Elder Scrolls IV Oblivion invited players into the expansive land of Tamriel, with groundbreaking graphics, a vast open world, and deep storytelling. And this game set a new benchmark for the role-playing game genre and solidified its place in the heart of gamers worldwide.
And
it created an even better game called Skyrim?
It did. To be fair, so I was introduced to Elder Scrolls III Morrowind, but I couldn't get into it, but I eventually went back and played it and appreciate it.
Yeah, I still haven't done Morrowind self.
It's good.
What about you, Ryan?
I never played the game myself, but I did have a roommate at one point who, this would have been on the original Xbox, had his character, I'm pretty sure it was Morrowind, not Oblivion, wanting to pump up his, I don't know if his endurance or running stats. He was inside a room and he taped his Xbox controller joystick to like run his character into a corner like overnight while he was out and about.
That's incredible.
Dedication.
Wow. But hey, if it works, it works, right?
Well, that was Adam that introduced me to Morrowind, so, you know. That's all I need to say about that.
What's that supposed to mean, Dave?
Hell no.
Dedication.
Mm-hmm, exactly. Ryan gets it.
All right, so the last stop for this week in gaming history, a personal favorite of mine for this week.
Yeah.
On March 19th of 2019, Satisfactory was released by Coffee Stain Studios into Early Access, inviting players into an open-world exploration and factory-building extravaganza.
Isn't that a great way to put it? Factory-building extravaganza.
It really is.
I'm proud of that one.
It's damn good. For those that know the game, that there's no better way to describe it.
Yeah.
So Satisfactory is set on an alien planet, and players are tasked with constructing and optimizing sprawling industrial complexes while managing resources and exploring the lush alien environment.
They chose a great title for, you know, like news headlines. If they named the game Mediocre, it'd be probably a bad idea.
Mediocrity, I don't know. A lot of great stuff that came out this week. A lot of favorites in there. It's a fantastic week.
Oh yes, this is one of the great weeks in gaming history. But they all are, because, you know, they always bring up a topic that we get to discuss, yep. Such as Metroid.
We previously covered the original Metroid in episode 51, long time ago. But with most of our stories, we always like to go back and look at the beginning to gain an understanding of where we are now. So we're heading back to the mid-80s, and Nintendo is on fire, right? They're just printing money with the release of the NES in 83. Then it comes to North America in 1985, just in time for Super Mario Bros. To be released alongside it. And then, as we learned recently, as we were getting the NES here stateside, Nintendo was about to release the Famicom Disk System peripheral for their Famicom system, right? And if you didn't catch that episode, which was The Legend of Zelda, the Famicom Disk System was an add-on for their version of the NES that used floppy disks instead of cartridges as its media, right? And it had a few other features added in, but the addition, like, of cheap storage to the Nintendo, like, ecosystem allowed game developers to create games at a scope that was unlike anything that they had created before. And what we talked about in that episode is that scope was worlds, vast worlds that were much bigger than anything they had tried before. You know, as it pertained to Zelda, that meant a huge overworld, enemies, there were more sounds. There was a lot of world building that developers were unable to do with the limited space that the cartridges had to offer, right? So one of the development teams at Nintendo, which was Research and Development Division 4, R&D 4, they're making Super Mario Brothers and The Legend of Zelda at the same time. Mario is going to be the showcase for cartridge media, and Zelda is being made to be everything that Mario isn't, and to show off what the disc system really has to offer. But there's one other development team at Nintendo in a different division, Research and Development 1, that's also looking to make games for these systems. They're looking at Mario, and they're looking at Zelda, and they're thinking to themselves, how great would it be if we combined what we like about these games? So Mario has this great platform jumping, while The Legend of Zelda has this great open world that you can explore however you choose to do so. Open world, open-ended, so to speak. But they wanted to position themselves in a way that would allow them to make something that was completely different from what R&D4 was making. And in order to do so, they decided that unlike the bright, vibrant, more so positive vibes that Mario and to a certain extent Zelda was putting out into the world, they wanted to do darker, moodier, this real, like, almost gothic aesthetic. And so they wanted to make their game, which would end up being Metroid, moody. That's the best way to put it. And so they made this game, right? There are definitely some fun things that you should know about Metroid. You know, the famous twist that everyone loves to talk about, that Samus, the main character, is actually a woman. That was really not planned, but partway through development, one of the developers looked around the room and he simply asked the others, hey, wouldn't it be cool if the person inside the suit was a woman? That's it. The rest is history. Everyone was like, yeah, cool. That's great. Because it was what different. That was different. I know.
And then everyone clapped.
And then everyone, right? Right? That's exactly how that should go if the internet was around back then. Well, it's now, and we still do it. You should also know that Metroid is important because alongside The Legend of Zelda, it helped popularize the idea of acquiring tools and permanent power-ups to help progress through the game. You know, up until this point, most games were kind of the way Mario was designed, right? You know, Mario has the star. Mario has the mushrups. Mushrups.
The mushrups.
I just made a new saying for the Mario series, mushrups. Mario has the mushrooms. These are temporary power-ups that help you progress through the game. But when Zelda came out, you collected your tools. You collected the recorder. You collected your sword and the shields and the boomerang. And these are tools that you kept with you through the entire game that helped you become stronger and helped you progress through the game. And this was a new concept by the time Zelda came along. There weren't many games that were doing it. And it's something that Metroid took and really added on to. Like, these were the two games that kind of made that a thing. I don't know. I don't remember other games that did it back then. Do you, Ryan?
No.
I don't. I mean, like, it, I, you know, really, aside from role-playing games, because you had, like, the Dragon Warriors and that at the time, Dragon Quest, Final Fantasy, but, like, on the action-adventure side, this is where it started, and then, of course, that was always part of the role-playing genre, so. So the team creates Metroid, and basically releases it as a launch title for the Famicom Disk System. That was August of 19... Or not a launch title. Zelda was the launch title. Metroid came out a little bit later in August of 1986. And it was about this time that there was yet another team in the R&D 1 division that was working on kind of Nintendo's next big thing, which was breaking into the handheld market with the Nintendo Game Boy. So this R&D team on the software side of things, because that's the hardware side, this team was tasked with making another Metroid game for the upcoming Game Boy handheld. Before I get into this, Ryan, have you played all of them at this point?
Mainline Metroid games, yes.
But not the offshoots like the Federation 1 and...
Haven't done Federation Force or Prime Hunters. I have done a little bit of Metroid Prime Pinball, however.
How about Other M? Do you consider that mainline?
I would... I don't think so. I have not played that one. But, yeah. Okay. Haven't heard great things there.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's an, those are all those are outliers. I'm really interested though that you've played pinball. I don't know why, but I find that incredibly amusing. So, bing bing.
One of those things where it's just so dumb it must work.
Yeah, that yeah, absolutely. So this R&D team on the hardware side is making the Game Boy, and this other team that had just, you know, gotten done making Metroid for the NES or Famicom is asked to make a Metroid title for the Game Boy. And so they're tasked, almost the same team, with making Metroid 2 The Return of Samus, and they're doing so within the limitations of the Game Boy, right? Because the Game Boy is black and white color. No color palette. It's a black and white palette. It's lower pixels. It's got a lot of limitations. But what this forced the team to do while we're on history is it forced the design team to make some changes to Samus, changes that stuck and became staples throughout the entire series. So like in the original Metroid, the team mostly used colors to distinguish between different weapons and suits that Samus wears. But in Metroid 2, The Return of Samus, like, there were color did not exist, right? So you couldn't rely on color to distinguish between things. So the team was forced to make design changes to the suits in particular that gave them what's now an iconic look and helped distinguish from one to the other. So like the Varius suit, specifically in the first one. Like, the Varius suit has a very distinct look that has been passed down subsequently through most of the series, and that started with Metroid 2, and that was invented out of the necessity of there being a physical design change without color to lean on anymore, which is kind of cool. So, also, Metroid 2 introduced us to the space jump, and introduced us to the spacer beam, and introduced us to the spider ball. Again, things that we have seen in all of these other Metroid games. So the team releases Metroid 2 to the world. It has since sold 1.7 million copies, so not too terrible for a Game Boy game made in 1991, I believe. You know, Metroid was a great game, and so people were looking for something else, because when you have a good video game series, people are always looking to buy something new that comes out for it. And speaking of making something completely new, have you ever considered making your own podcast? Do you have something clever and engrossing that you'd like to share with the world, but you really don't know how? Our friends at Zencastr have created an all-in-one podcasting suite of tools that makes it easier than ever to create your own podcast.
With Zencastr, it's super easy to record a podcast. Everyone logs in using their web browser, and you just start recording a high-quality podcast right away. It allows you to record up to 4K video with your guests, and with Zencastr's multi-layered backups, you always have the highest quality recordings, even if the connection is unstable.
And with Zencastr, you never have to worry about what you sound like. Zencastr's post-production process makes you sound better than ever. It automatically removes all those ums and ahs, gets rid of awkward pauses in conversation. You can set the right podcast loudness. You can split up your tracks. You can reduce cross-gating and background noise. It's just a bunch of selections, and then with a single click of the button, away it goes. You don't even have to wait for it. It emails you when your post-production is finished to tell you that you can come download your finished product now.
And if the thought of podcasting overwhelms you because you think you need tons of different tools and services, relax. Those days are over. With Zencastr's all-in-one podcasting platform, you can create your podcast in one place and distribute it to Spotify, Apple, and other major destinations.
So if you'd like to start your own podcast, or maybe you want to take your current one to the next level, we've got a deal for you. Go to zencastr.com/pricing and use our offer code MemoryCardLane. You'll get 30% off the first month of any Zencastr paid plan.
Sign up for Zencastr today, and you can experience the same ease in producing your own high-quality podcast as we do each week. Go out and share your ideas with the world.
So in the wake of Metroid 2, the team waited. They definitely were not ready to share their ideas with the world. In a 2010 interview, director and writer of Super Metroid, Yoshio Sakamoto said, "We wanted to wait until a true action game was needed, and also to set the stage for the reappearance of Samus. It took half a year for Nintendo to approve the project and 2 further years to develop." But realistically, the team didn't wait. Metroid 2 was released in November of 1991, and I found articles with other interviews that suggested that development on Super Metroid started in the fall of 1991, so about the same time. Supposedly, the way it went down was that Makoto Kano, the character designer, like the creator of Metroid, the guy who came up with Samus, he went to Sakamoto, and he basically had an offer to make a Metroid title for Nintendo's new system, which would have been the Super Nintendo / Famicom, which had just released in 1990. The Famicom was 90, I think the Super Nintendo was 91. And he basically said, "I'll do the environment if you help me make the rest of the game." And he added to the argument that Metroid was really popular in North America, more so than in Japan. And so he encouraged Sakamoto to produce a new Metroid game with the high quality graphics that were becoming possible, at least what they envisioned possible on the Super Famicom. And of course, I mean, they had already made 2 Metroid games. They both enjoyed the process, from what I understand. So, I mean, Sakamoto was right on board. You know, the game design, the concept, kind of the basis for the story, this had already kind of been established when they sat down to write Metroid 2. They already kind of had a roadmap for what they were planning on going. So realistically, like, the framework was already in place for this one. So they teamed up to remake a new title in the Metroid series. Makoto Kano would be the producer, and Yoshio Sakamoto would become the director. In that same 2010 interview, Sakamoto said, "When it came time to make another sequel, this time for the Super Famicom, we really wanted to see how far we could push the Famicom to generate greater power of expression and enhance the appearance of the game world, all while working with basically an unchanged concept. That was our initial motivation as far as Super Metroid was concerned, was to build on the expressiveness of Metroid 2 and achieve greater presence, something closer to reality." That's kind of funny that he put it that way when, like, it's so sci-fi, it's not even funny.
And for much of the first year of development, the team really just had to learn how to make a game for the Super Nintendo, because they said that development on the SNES was vastly different than the NES that they had made the original on. And I'm guessing vastly different from the Game Boy, because I didn't see anyone complain about the Game Boy, so I'm not really sure what changed going to 16-bit.
I think about 8 bits.
Oh my god.
I was just double checking the math. I think that holds up, yeah.
Come on, Dave. Come on.
That's almost double the bits.
This is so bad. I love it. For the prototype stage of Super Metroid's development, he said, "We just had a few intelligent systems programming staff. That was a company that helped program Nintendo games. They had worked on the first Metroid. They just had a few IS programming staff, myself and another Nintendo designer. We examined what was possible in the game, and as the Koi met Koi?
Yeah, Koi.
The game just wanted to be Koi. As the core Metroid system was already in place, we considered how we could make the game easier to play, what new ideas we could incorporate, and so on." And once they were through that prototype phase, it was really time for the team to grow. The team's objective was to build on the success of Metroid and Metroid 2. But only three of the original Metroid team, including Sakamoto, worked on Super Metroid. The rest of the Nintendo team, he said, was made up of young trainee developers. And as he put it, young people can be quite impertinent, and those on the Super Metroid team certainly were, but I think that's quite important in a way. These young people had enough about them to help us a lot. There were many different personalities in the Super Metroid team, which was a good thing. It was a harsh development environment, so I'm sure that some of the staff didn't enjoy the work, but generally the team was full of the "let's go for it" spirit. I think that was partly because of the timing as well, what with the Super Famicom pushing everything to the next level. One of the driving notions behind the design of Super Metroid was that they wanted to make something that people would compare to a movie. Now, if we step back to the original Metroid was very much influenced by two very specific influences, right? One was the Alien series, Ridley Scott's Alien movies, and the second was the bio art, biomechanical like look art of H.R. Giger. We did an episode on H.R. Giger, didn't we? Wasn't there a weird game that we did H.R. Giger on last year? There was. I know there was.
I can't count, Dave.
So they already kind of had this influence and they wanted to make something compared to a movie. In fact, Sakamoto recorded something on a VHS tape. I couldn't find one. I genuinely looked for it. He recorded something on a VHS tape that was like, this is what I want this game to look like. This is the aesthetic. This is what I'm going for. And that, whatever he recorded, was said to really influence like the title screen of the game, which is basically like the Metroid in a broken tank with a bunch of dead scientists around it, right? That's supposed to be like your introduction to, uh-oh, some crap has gone down. So, yeah, so they wanted to compare it to a movie. We really didn't want to explain things to the player using too many words, Sakamoto stated. We just wanted to let them play and be able to work things out for themselves. For example, say there's a mechanism where you need to climb up a ladder and place a bomb there in order to advance as one component in the solution of a gameplay riddle. If that was all you needed to do in order to get through the next area, you'd miss all the other mechanisms that we put in place and wouldn't even realize that certain parts of the game existed. We wanted players to explore everything we'd made and then move on. That's why we designed the maps in such a way that the player couldn't escape without exploration, or such a way that the player would end up back at a starting point before advancing. The player would be cornered or driven and would eventually be forced to stop and say, "Right, how should I think about this area?" That's the essential point of Super Metroid's design. Not using words meant that the player had to feel his or her way through the game, and that's how we wanted it to be. When they discovered something new, a new item, or a new location, we wanted a player to feel that he or she had made that discovery independently without help from the game. Super Metroid is, like I already said, along with Castlevania Symphony of the Night, these are the two games that really define the Castle or Metroidvania genre, right? And this was the beginning of it. Ryan, I'm going to throw it to you. Did you play this back in the NES today, or did you come back to this later?
The original Metroid, I did not play back in the day.
Okay. And Super?
Super I did play back in the day. And, you know, some of the, you know, improvements, specifically the map, you know, in terms of, you know, made it a very different experience going back to original Metroid and just being, you know, thrown in the dark, so to speak.
So I had a similar experience. I did not start with Metroid. I started with Super Metroid. I have always had a love, at least as long as I can remember, I have a love for this genre. And it definitely started here for me. I remember thinking about, like, and we've talked about this before, how the scale of things changes when, like, from being a kid to being an adult. And I remember thinking, how effing huge is this world, right? Because it just, it has room after room after room, and then area after area after area. And then, like, there were secret blocks. There were blocks that could only be broken with this missile, or then the super missile, and then you had to backtrack through here. And I just, and then, like, there were, what, areas you could only get to with the moonwalk and the super fast run, right?
It was not shy about not holding your hand.
It did not hold your hand, and you had to do lots of backtracking whatsoever, but it was huge. And it had the map, and the map showed you what you explored versus what you didn't explore, which made it a little easier. Like, that appeals to the completionist in me, right? Because I have to find out what every like every room is, every square. Every square has to be colored to know that I did it. You know, did I get the missiles out of there? Did I find another power up out of there? Like, I remember this appealing to the completionist in me, that I had to find everything, absolutely everything. And it's one of the earliest games I can ever remember being compelled to do so. But it's also one of the earliest games I think that was a thing. In this time period, I remember this being my completionist game, and I remember Mega Man X being my completionist game, which I think is similar time periods. It might be 1 year later for Mega Man X, I think. I don't know. But this one was awesome. Like, I don't know. I was glued to this one. This was a game that not only was I glued to, but I played it multiple times at this, like I, as a kid, even played it multiple times. I'm a big Super Metroid fan. So as Sakamoto said, it was a demanding design environment, right? But remarkably, he noted there was no friction. You know, they were really crunched during that last stage of development. He did note that the offices smelled awful. He said, during the final 6 months of development, I didn't know where I lived anymore, whether it was the Nintendo building. It became more like a boarding house to the Super Metroid team. And it got to the stage where, like, he didn't remember going home at all. There was a nap room they set up where it was okay for people to sleep, but it was often full of, like, sleeping, overworked staff. And those were the time that he remembers, right? When he wanted to sleep, but he couldn't because the room was packed and didn't have time to go home. There was always, like, 10 to 15 people in the office through the night. They had to, like, take naps in rotation. And the nap room wasn't being cleaned or looked after at all because people were always using it. So he said that that room smelled like a zoo.
Nice.
Which is just awful to think about. He recalled a story too where another Nintendo employee put a air freshener in the room, but that made only made the place smell even worse.
That, you gotta love it. I mean, what better place to be doing the work?
In that later interview, Sakamoto was asked about his game design and how it contributed to the lasting appeal through all the years. And he said, "I want to make something lasting that will be fun, even if it's played much later. All I can say is that I'm really happy that we succeeded in that goal. If I had to take a guess as to what the lasting appeal is, perhaps it's the impression left on people by the drama of the game. You have a baby Metroid who's stolen in the beginning of the game, and Samus goes after the baby. The baby's getting larger and larger as it grows and feeds, and when they are first reunited with the baby, it attacks Samus, but then remembers who she is and runs off. Later on, when Samus is in trouble, the baby Metroid comes back and helps her." And these are all dramatic moments that are really connected to strong feelings that people have about relationships. And I think that that leaves a quite an impression on you. So if there's anything that I feel is about the lasting appeal to the game, that has to come from the deep impression that's left by that sort of thing. So Ryan, is that the impression that you are left with from the game?
The impression that I am left with the game is one of, you know, kind of loneliness.
Yeah.
Sorrow.
Yeah.
Yeah, just from the atmosphere of the game and the music. And yeah.
It has a great soundtrack.
It really does.
That is not my impression of the game either. When I think back to Super Metroid, I think of exploration. I think of a sense of discovery. I think of a sense of progress, because every time you find a new power up, it basically unlocks a new part of the map that you couldn't access before. Mm. So progression, right? But in all honesty, I don't know, like, prior to having to sit down and revisit this for this episode, I don't know if I could have told you like that entire story for Super Metroid, which is, I don't know if that's sad. I don't know if that's sad or not. I don't know. What, but I do know the story in the back of my head, because I have played all the main lines in Prime, except for Dread. I haven't played Dread yet. So I don't know. I guess that story doesn't stick with me as much. I do remember at the end, you can rescue the animals or not. I remember that much. The little ostrichy thingies, I guess. What were they? Dadricks or whatever?
I do remember feeling sorrow at the end when a certain event happens.
True. That is very true. Yeah. I'll give you... So maybe that's a good way to put it. Maybe I don't remember the story in terms of that, but I do remember the feelings that were associated with it. And that sorrow is a really good way, because you just went to, like, you talked about isolation, and I guess those that loneliness, everything kind of goes together, because, like, momentarily it doesn't exist, right? Because you link up again and then it's there again, right? I mean, it was spoiler. We're this many years in, so I mean, I'm not. I don't feel bad for bringing that up.
So I did.
I know.
You monster.
I played this as an adult. I still think it holds up. And that's kind of what I want to talk about to take it out of here for today. Just a quick Google search will show you how loved this game is. It has won so many awards. It has been named to many different lists. There have been publications that have named it the best NES game of all time. In 2003, it was actually named the best game period of all time by Electronic Gaming Monthly. I mean, it's 20 years later, so I know that there are probably a buttload of games that have overtaken it. But at one time in its history, 10 years-ish, 9 years after it came out, I mean, there was a publication, a video game publication, that thought it was the best game of all time. There aren't many games that even get talked about in that breath, let alone get named as the best game of all time, right?
True.
So, pretty short list. Yeah, it's a short list. So, I mean, even if it's not your greatest game of all time, there's no doubt that Super Metroid is up there among the greatest games ever made. So I guess my question, Rob, and I know this is tough for you, so, I mean, I'll hit Ryan. Does that theory still hold up to you? Like, is this, like, it's on my list. Is it on your list still, too?
I will say it is definitely on my Mount Rushmore of the Metroidvanias genre, you know, to this day.
Yeah. Nothing's overtake. It's hard to not be on your Mount Rushmore when, there have been so many good additions, right? Because I just talked about the fact that Symphony of the Night is one of my favorite. And then, like, in recent times, the Ori games I've played, which are brilliant, brilliant, brilliant Metroidvanias. But every one of them sits on the shoulders of giants. Like, it's hard to not recognize that in any way, shape, or form.
There's been, you know, games even just limited to the Metroid series that make, changes and improvements to quality of life, whether that's, being able to grapple on ledges and pull up that's a benefit of the newer games, and trying to go back to the Super Metroid, it's hard to adjust not to be able to do that. But you mentioned, some of the Castlevanias. I mean, I've played so many Metroidvanias, whether it's, on the Game Boy Advance and DS, there was a long series of 2D Castlevania games on those, and all largely excellent. The Ori games, Hollow Knight, SteamWorld Dig, Guacamelee, Shadow Complex, Fez, the list goes on. Even as recently as January 2024, Prince of Persia, The Lost Crown.
Yep.
These are all fantastic additions that build on the history of this game combined with Symphony of the Night.
Yeah, I don't think, I think I agree with you, because I don't ever think you can take away what this, I mean, you can't take away what this did, because you're right, everything else is literally builds upon it. So however you feel about the design, the story, and everything in the game, it's real hard to deny the historical significance of it whatsoever. All right. So real quick, Rob, I got something that appeals to you. It'll appeal to you too, Ryan. But this game is talked about very commonly in the speedrunning community. Rob, I know you're a fan of speedrunning.
Si, senor.
And so I looked up the speedrunning records for this game. Rob, you're at an unfair advantage, so I'm gonna ask Ryan. Ryan, how fast, without glitches, in real time, like people real time, do you think someone has played through this game?
So you're saying no glitches, not tool assisted.
Nope. Any percent speed run.
Yeah, any percent. Okay, I don't know the answer, but I'm going to guess 18 minutes.
No, you got to double it for the any percent. The any percent is 40 minutes and 36 seconds. The glitch any percent. The glitch any percent. Take a gander at that one. You'd be off. You'd be over. I'll give you this. You'd be over with your guess.
Let's see. I'll say 11 minutes and 12 seconds.
Wow. That was damn good.
It's 11 minutes even.
Wow. All right.
Yeah. The any percent glitch is 11 minutes even. And the 100%. So full completion of the entire game. Take a gander at that one.
So any percent, no 100, glitches.
100%, was, no glitches. Yeah.
But any percent was 40 minutes, 36 seconds.
Yes. Yep.
Okay. I'll say an hour, 12 minutes.
Jesus.
How did you do that? It's spot on.
17 seconds.
1 hour.
But yes.
Yeah.
I undershot it. Sorry, guys.
The official is 1 hour, 12 minutes, 17 seconds, and 800 milliseconds.
Insane. That's damn good guesses.
And in case you didn't know, that record, that 100% record, was set just 17 days ago today. So people are still speedrunning this game and making attempts. I love looking up speedruns because people
Go ahead.
No, people comment, like they take notes with their speedruns when you look up the like speedrunning.com, the community, you know. And the person who did any percent at 40 minutes and 36 seconds just commented, "I think I'm done now." I mean, like, okay, cool, dude.
Fair enough.
How many seconds did they shave off when they set that record?
Who knows, man? I like the fact that the 100% had to get down to the millisecond, because there are literally other ones that are within like a second of it. That's why they had to go down to the millisecond. So, yeah, it's something else. So, but yeah, man, that's I don't know. This is one of those games. This is one of those greatest games of all time that I think is. I don't know. I think it's lost on a generation, but not at the same time. Because Metroid's still a thing. But, like, do you really think that the youngest generations have ever experienced Super Metroid or will experience Super Metroid? Maybe.
I think they have the opportunity through, if they have the Switch Online, I believe
that's very true. Yeah, you're right. Not only is it on Switch Online, but it was part of the classic console. So you're right. There are still ample opportunities to play this one if they want to choose so. But then that begs the question, does it hold up? Did it age well? I don't know. It's a tough one because I think we tend to look at it through rose colored glasses. You know what I mean? But
yeah, some of the things it does are, if you know, maybe falling out of favor in terms of it. It does not tell you, hey, go in this direction or go over here. It kind of leaves you to your own devices. So it's a different experience than a modern day game. It doesn't make it better or worse. It's just maybe different than what some people are used to.
That's very true. I don't know. I like it. I think it holds up well.
So we were talking about people being able to play the game in modern day. One of the ways people have, come to play Super Metroid today via emulation is there's what's known as the Super Metroid Randomizer, where it will take the ROM of your game that you've, acquired from a legal copy you own, and it will change all of the item locations.
I did not know that. That is incredibly fascinating.
And so instead of going left and getting the morph ball, you might find a missile upgrade or absolutely nothing. And so for those people who know the game like the back of their hand, it's a way for them to still play the game and find new and interesting challenges while, still playing the game that they love so much.
That is really fascinating. Are there other games that they've done that to, you think?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. I mean, I watch constantly people that do Pokemon Randomizer Nuzlockes. So it randomizes Pokemon's items, and then obviously they add the added challenge of the Nuzlocke on there. And I've seen Breath of the Wild has done in randomizers.
There's a Zelda Link to the Past randomizer, same thing. It randomly scrambles all of the items. And there's even a combo Link to the Past Metroid randomizer together that will put the two ROMs together. And then if you go in the door or into a cave entrance in the Zelda game, boom, you're now in, some door in Super Metroid.
What?
You have to know both games like the back of your hand, and you might find a Super Metroid power-up in a Zelda chest and vice versa.
That's badass.
It is mind-blowing, and the people who play it are golden gods.
You can't see me right now, but my jaw just is like, I have to pick it up off the desk, because that is... the fact that someone came up with that, like in a way that worked, and then B, like there are people that play through it that way. I'm in awe right now. That is so freaking cool.
That is incredible. My jaw was also dropped from that one.
That blows my mind. I learned something. That's cool. That's so cool. Man. So if you want to learn something more about the Metroid series, you can, of course, go back to the beginning. We did a whole episode on it in episode 51, which, of course, if you want to check out any of our old episodes, you can do so by going to our website, which is www.memorycardlane.com. Rob, what else can people find on our website?
Well, you can find a calendar of our future episodes, maybe talk about a little bit of something knowledge base you have about the topics at hand. You can find a link to our Discord where you can come tell David how wrong he is about things or just chat about whatever is going on in general. You can find a link to our Discord where you can help support us. Sorry. You can find a link to our Patreon where you can help support us and get access to ad-free and unedited versions of our episodes. And you can find links to our social media where I am on several platforms as Rob_O_Raptor and Dave.
I can be found on various platforms as David is wrong. Each week, we'll tell you a story about one topic relevant to the current week in gaming history. It can be about a game, a console, technology, just something that I've arbitrarily found relevant. That's not arbitrary. It literally has to be relevant. It's the way my brain works. While doing so, we hope to teach you something new about the topic, what it took from the world as its inspiration, or what it gave back to the world in its legacy. Actually, why I do this podcast is because each week when I get to sit down and research a new topic, I learn things. I love learning things. My brain just soaks up knowledge like a sponge. I will never get tired of learning new things. And I get to take those new things and I get to teach them to other people with the hope that they too have sponge brains. And we all act sponge brainy together and learn new things. A recognition of how great this process is. Each week we do a roundtable, talk about what we've learned. So, esteemed guest Ryan Shepherd, what did you learn today?
One of the things I learned today from you fine gentlemen is that there was a Super Mario power-up called Rush-Rups.
Mushrooms. Yeah, we got it. Mushrooms. Absolutely. Don't forget about those mushrooms. I love it. Rob, what did you learn today?
Well, I learned that the Super Metroid team lived like a college dorm for 6 months. And, you know, if that's not a testament to the dedication of the team, but also it also is kind of the toxic work environment. It's kind of a double-edged sword, but you know, obviously they were passionate about it. They were willing to put in the effort and wreak doing so. And they busted out a fantastic game from what it sounds like. I've never played it myself, but just from everything I've heard, it's a testament to the work that they put in. So, you know, it's fantastic what you can do with dedication and, passion. And it's just hilarious to know that it was a dorm room. Like, I mean, come on.
I've also
smelled like a zoo. Sorry, go ahead, Ryan.
I've also learned that Dave hasn't played Metroid Dread.
I have not. No, it's on my list. So
there's still time.
I'm working on it. I pulled up this is what I learned today. I learned that there was a Super Metroid and Link to the Past combo randomizer. It's currently in version 11.3.1. And wow, can you customize this? Like, wow, you can change the number of crystals that you need to open Ganon's Tower. You can make the goal to have to defeat all dungeons in Mother Brain or defeat Ganon in Mother Brain. Hell, you can do a single player or a multi-world version that has two players. So you can apparently randomize them as a multi-world. You can shuffle keys, shuffle swords. You can put the morph ball in its original location or random. Like the amount of stuff that you can do. You can turn Super Metroid, like, it asks you if you want it to be normal or hard, the logic of the game. Wow. There's a lot of customization in this randomizer. It is super cool, and that's what I learned today. So thank you for bringing that to my attention. I think this is awesome. Wow. Good lord, a lot of customization. Great, fantastic, awesome, love it to death. Well, that's another successful episode. First of all, Ryan, thank you again for coming.
It's always my pleasure. I have one last fun fact to leave the audience off with, if you'd like.
Yeah, absolutely. What is that?
Well, at the time Super Metroid released, it was the largest SNES game up to that point. 3 megabytes.
Wow, that is huge.
The average selfie our audience takes these days is probably double that. Just to put that in perspective.
Crazy when you think about it.
It's true. It's very, very true. All right, Rob, before I take it out of here, is there anything else you'd like to add to today's episode?
Well, first, a special thank you to Ryan for joining us. It's always a pleasure. And, you know, as a four-peat, like you said, one more and we got to get you that blue jacket. So, Dave, keep that in mind.
It's very, very true. And with that, fellow gamers, it brings us to the end of our journey through the eerie, alien-infested corridors of Zeebs and Super Metroid. From its atmospheric exploration to its intense battle, Samus Aran's quest against the space pirates has left an indelible mark on the gaming landscape, blending action with a story of solitude and survival on an alien world. But as one adventure concludes, another awaits on the horizon. Next week, we're trading in the sci-fi extraterrestrial realms for the vast medieval lands of Tamriel, as we delve into the beginning of a franchise we talked about in the beginning today, the beginning of a franchise that would redefine the role-playing genre as we take a look at the Elder Scrolls Arena. Prepare to step into a world where every choice and every path is yours to make in a quest that spans an entire continent. So fellow explorers of digital worlds, as we bid farewell to the Metroids and Mother Brain, let's ready our maps and compasses for an entirely different kind of adventure. Until next time, keep those curiosity sparks flying and prepare for a journey where history, magic, and destiny converge as we take yet another trip down memory card lane. Do the thing.
Do-be-da-m-ba-m-ba-m-ba-m-do-a.
Dong.
Shit.